Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have CFR Senior Fellow Isabel Coleman with us today. Isabel Coleman directs the Civil Society, Markets, and Democracy Initiative at CFR and writes the CFR blog, Democracy in Development, which we circulated in advance of this call. An expert on the Middle East, Dr. Coleman is the author of numerous publications, including Paradise Beneath Her Feet. Her writings have also appeared in countless publications in print and online. In 2011, Newsweek named Dr. Coleman as one of 150 women who shake the world. Isabel, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could give us an overview of what we're seeing today in Egypt and talk about how the turmoil is affecting the religious minorities within the country.
Sure. Thank you, Irina, and thanks for organizing this. Well, as everybody knows, Egypt is very chaotic right now. I personally was meant to be in Egypt Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, coming back tomorrow. I was in the region and was meant to fly from, I was in Israel last week, was meant to fly from there to Cairo on Sunday and ended up postponing that trip just because the situation is so fluid, and it was very unclear what's happening. It has been more quiet in recent days. I almost ended up going on Sunday because it seemed like things had quieted down, but I knew that to expect more violence, and I think that actually has been borne out just yesterday and over last night. There were more violent clashes between Muslim Brotherhood supporters and the government, and several more people have been killed, and numerous squares have been shut down. There's a lot of police activity all over the city. It's still quite chaotic, I would say. Just today, the government announced its new cabinet, and apparently no one from the Muslim Brotherhood is, or not, no one from an Islamist group is a member of that new government. The government itself is saying, well, we asked Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist representatives to participate, and they declined, whereas the Muslim Brotherhood is saying, indeed, we were not asked. So it's not really clear. It's a, you know, he said situation. But what is clear is that the country is very deeply divided, and Christians and other minority groups are in many ways feeling the brunt of the situation. There have been some high-profile attacks against Christian communities since Morsi's overthrow a couple of weeks ago. I think you're seeing these attacks stemming for a couple of different reasons. One is that you do have a situation of some chaos and lawlessness going on, particularly in the Sinai where some of these attacks have occurred. You're also seeing people feeling, particularly the more extreme Islamist groups, that Islam in the country is under threat and that they need to protect Islam. And you've seen Islamic militants saying some very extremist things and acting in an extremist fashion against Christian minorities for those reasons. I would say that, of course, attacks against Christian and minority groups in Egypt are not new. They occurred throughout the Mubarak era, just in the last 14 months of Mubarak's term in Egypt, 23 Christians were killed, and many of those were not prosecuted. So this is not something that has erupted that's new. It's got a long history in Egypt. The Morsi government, of course, didn't improve the situation for Christian minorities. They implemented a quite exclusionary constitution that gave new powers to Islamic courts, and you saw the emphasis on the tenets of Sharia law in the Constitution, a designation that Al-Azhar, university would be the sole interpreter of Sharia law, and that was in the Morsi Constitution. But I would add that the new government has implemented a constitution that is really apparently no better than what the Morsi government had in terms of inclusion and exclusion of religious minorities and freedom. So that's something to look at. In addition, the Morsi government, you know, there was a big problem with the police turning a blind eye to what was going on in terms of attacks against Christians and other minority groups. And you had just this spring a number of significant attacks that the police really just didn't even show up for. And, you know, some point to the Morsi government, you know, blaming them, oh, look, the Muslim Brotherhood's in charge and they're not implementing firm rule of law. They're not having the police track down and respond in a timely fashion to these attacks. But I can tell you I've also heard quite a different perspective on this from people in the Morsi government, and I give some credence to that, which is that one of their big problems is they never controlled the police, and they were not able to get the police to respond in any alacrity in any way, not only to what was going on with attacks against Christians, but also to attacks in the Sinai, not just against Christians and other groups, but just in general. There was a sense of the police being absent during the Morsi government and not responding. Militant attacks in the Sinai, and the army, too, was not responsive to the Morsi government. I think you've seen now this play out, that both the police and the military were very firmly against the Morsi government and were not being helpful in any respect on clamping down on the escalating violence that has happened in Egypt over the last couple of years. Why? Well, was it to embarrass the Morsi government? Was it to just not participate with the Morsi government? I mean, there are all sorts of explanations we can come up with for that. But I do think you've seen this tension between sources of power and accountability within Egypt, and that has just only escalated. What to expect going forward? Well, we're in for a very rough ride. The Muslim Brotherhood, for better or worse, is, you know, a very deeply embedded institution in the Egyptian social fabric and now political fabric. Since the time it was formed in 1928, the Muslim Brotherhood has experienced some very widespread popular support. Even though it was disbanded by the government in 1948, the Egyptian government, precisely because it enjoyed such support, it had as many as 2 million members by that point, and it was feeling threatened. And despite being disbanded, despite being repressed quite violently in the 50s, 60s, up until the 70s, it has continued to thrive as an organization. The Muslim Brotherhood renounced violence in the 1970s. It reluctantly took part in the democratic, you know, experiment in Egypt, and I think you're going to find that members of the Muslim Brotherhood today are already talking about their bitterness, their disillusion, their disappointment, that democracy is clearly not for them. It was a mistake to participate in democracy. Right now, they are talking about a peaceful, nonviolent protest to the coup that ousted the Morsi government. How long they will be talking about peaceful protest is not clear, particularly as the violent attacks continue. And I would say that to count the Muslim Brotherhood out, as some have been doing, saying this is sort of the end of political Islam in the region, is grossly premature. This is an organization that has suffered through and thrived on repression for decades. And if indeed the government continues to repress it, it will only, unfortunately, re-energize the organization, I think. They're very good at playing the victim, and they have a good victim story to tell right now. And to think that if there were elections held, parliamentary elections are supposed to be held 6 months from now, if in fact those elections are held, how would the Muslim Brotherhood fare? Well, I think a lot depends on what happens in the next 6 months, but by no means would I count them out as a social and political organization in Egypt. So, Arena, maybe I'll just stop there, and I'm happy to take questions.
Great. Thanks very much, Isabel. Let's open up to the group.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Paul Debris with the New York Divinity School.
Thank you so much for this excellent broad background. I think as a Christian leader in the United States, we feel hopeless, helpless to protect religious minorities in Egypt. As just for citizens, what do you suggest that we could do to encourage the present leaders to protect all minorities?
Well, I think there are a couple of different levers and pathways. I mean, certainly there's the physical protection, and some of the attacks that have occurred in this environment of lawlessness. When it takes the police 2 hours to even show up when a Christian community is under attack, I mean, that's completely unacceptable. And calling the Egyptians out on that, I think, is really important. And calling for calm, calling for peace, calling for peaceful demonstrations, as the Obama administration has done, is necessary but not sufficient. I think that really coming down more firmly and something that we should have been doing all along now in Egypt, and demanding that that the extensive security forces that are there, and certainly the military that is there, that has been trained and supplied by the United States with aid from the United States, that it is used to protect all Egyptian citizens. And I think that point needs to be made very clearly. Both sides, and when I alluded to this earlier, that the Morsi government, I think, has been blamed for the police not showing up and not responding to attacks on Christians. And I think in many respects, I'm in no way a defender of the Morsi government. They made lots of mistakes. I'm not a fan of the Muslim Brotherhood. On the other hand, I would not pin this specifically on them. I think they really had very little ability to control and direct the police and the military in Egypt, and that it has... Egyptians know in the military and police that when there are attacks on Christians, it makes headlines around the world, in the United States in particular, and that it's a way to embarrass those who are in power. So, using that information, knowing that it is a sensitive point, we should be very firm on expressing our dismay about those attacks and those incidents.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Aza Karim with UNSPA.
Hello. Thank you so much again, Isabel, for a wonderful briefing, which is always a pleasure to hear you talk. So thank you. A couple of questions that I wanted to get your reading about. One was the dissonance between the Salafist movement and the Brotherhood, and where you think that's placing the Islamist resistance as a whole to this current interim administration. And the second was your reading of, when I heard you speak about the importance of making sure that there's an accountability mechanism for the Egyptian government, whatever it is, for the minorities. And I'm wondering to what extent we should also be exploring avenues of trying to change certain attitudes and social norms about minorities and treatment thereof, and what role, what venues or roles you see, or you would sort of guide about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Two good questions. Regarding the first, Egypt is experiencing very, very fluid politics right now. And you've seen some surprising alliances that are so surprising that they actually come undone quite quickly. One of them, of course, was the alliance between the secular liberals and the Salafis, who, when push came to shove, they were quite quick to abandon Morsi at his hour of need. The Salafis, the Al-Nur party, was very much in the streets calling for an overthrow of the Morsi government 2 weeks ago. But these are very strange bedfellows. I mean, the Salafis in bed with the liberals or vice versa, and, you know, it's almost mind-boggling to think of that. But now, here you have the new government being formed. Not only are there no Muslim Brotherhood members, there are no Salafist members either. And, you know, how the Salafists, I mean, play this will be quite interesting because they, in some respects, were supportive of Morsi in the beginning because, look, when you look at the spectrum out there, the Morsi government, on the one hand, the Muslim Brotherhood are competitors to the Salafists. On another, they're the most least objectionable, I should say, political party out there from a Salafist perspective, that because ultimately they share a similar vision in creating an Islamic State. But they are rivals, and they're political rivals, and they have not cooperated in many respects. So where it goes from here, I don't really know. The Salafists have played, I would argue, they were playing quite a conciliatory and even in many ways an accommodating role during the spring, calling for compromise, calling for Morsi to really listen to the demands of the people, and seeking some type of compromise. Now, when that didn't happen, you know, they really made it clear that they were in the streets against the Morsi government. But where do they go from here? I mean, they played a card. The Al-Nur party said, you know, when they were looking at who would be the new interim president, Al-Baradei's name was floated, and the Salafis used their veto, in effect, to say, you know, we can't tolerate him. He's too secular, too liberal for us. But what you, I think you'll see going forward now is a lot of tussle over the writing of this new constitution. And the Salafis have a lot to lose. They had a preferential role for Islam in the Morsi constitution, and I think you're going to see that setback in whatever constitution comes out of this transitional government in Egypt. And whether or not it even is a transitional government, because you've now seen General al-Sisi accruing, you know, more power to himself in recent days in a somewhat opaque way, which cannot make the Salafists happy. Just briefly on your last point, yes, changing perspectives about minorities in Egypt is critically important, but it takes a long time to do it, and we're dealing with very urgent issues right now that, yes, when the dust settles, to return to this idea of changing attitudes through media, through curriculum, through education, through all of these different mediums are important, but they're right now, you know, we're just dealing with a crisis situation where it's hard to think long term.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Drew Christensen with Boston College.
Hello. Thank you very much for a very clear presentation. My question is, why has the interim government, given the breadth of the general uprising, not been more open in its transitional constitution for minority groups, especially religious groups?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I can question lots of things that the interim government is doing right now, and I think they're making a very big mistake by arresting the leadership of the Brotherhood, of putting them under house arrest or in physical arrest. Flinging allegations that they all need to be indicted and put on trial for what? I mean, this was the government just a few weeks ago, and now they're talking about putting these people on trial. It's got a real sort of show trial feel to it for me. And, you know, going down a path that makes any type of compromise or reconciliation seem increasingly impossible. And to me, those are really bad decisions that they're making. The current constitution, it seems to have been rushed through. these clauses that they're amending. The question remains on what the whole process will be for moving from where they are now to something different. As I said earlier, there is a plan that has been proposed to hold parliamentary elections in 6 months and to have this group write a constitution in the meantime. But I can only imagine under the current context how deeply divisive that whole process will continue to be. But just one more point I would make is that, you know, we talk about Christian minority in Egypt, and I think it's important to keep in mind that there's some very, very powerful and influential Christian leaders, not just religious leaders, but business leaders in Egypt. And they have played a very significant role in this whole overthrow of the Morsi government. And Naguib Sawiris, who's a billionaire and a scion of a billionaire family, industrial family that has its economic fingers in many different pies in Egypt. Naguib Sawiris, I recommend you look at his Charlie Rose interview from a few weeks ago, where he said that there would be an overthrow of the Morsi government, and it was inevitable, and it was coming down the pike. And only after that did it become clear the role that he played in funding Tamarut, this rebellion movement. There are Christian leaders like him who've played a very vocal role, and I have to imagine that they're going to really do all that they can to make sure that minority rights are protected. But, you know, they're swimming with sharks, is all I can say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Chain of Washington Diocese.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is just a simple a question about the role of Al-Azhar University, and also if you have any information about Al-Tayeb and his involvement or his silence or his voice as all of this has been unfolding most recently.
Well, Al-Azhar has been very much in the thick of it from the beginning. If you remember back, Al-Tayeb got himself in hot water because at the overthrow of the Mubarak government, he was one of the last voices, you know, clinging to Mubarak, saying, hey, he's not such a bad guy, you know, let's give him a chance and these types of things, which put him under a lot of scrutiny after Mubarak's fall, with people saying, you know, we want Tayeb's head, he should go. He was only saying those nice things because he owed his job to Mubarak, all of which is true, of course. But I also think that Tayeb probably read the tea leaves and said, he's a moderate, a Sufi. You know, he's got real Sufi tendencies, and he probably looked around and said, I'm not going to do any better under a more, quote, democratic system that's going to be dominated by more conservative Islamic voices. And he was right. Al-Azhar's come under a lot of pressure. So you saw Tayeb actually making statements during the June 30th and shortly thereafter, that 48-hour period, calling for Morsi to step down. So that, you know, has put Al-Azhar back into the thick of it. The role of Al-Azhar in any type of new constitution will be very controversial. It has been a flashpoint so far, and it will continue to be, because you do have various articles in the existing constitution that give article, I think it is 219 in particular, that gives Al-Azhar a role in interpreting the constitution. And, you know, that, I think, was inserted. It was supported by both the Muslim Brotherhood itself, by the Salafis, and reluctantly by the liberals, who each of them thinking, okay, well, Islam is inevitable in the Constitution. It's always been in the Constitution. It's going to be in this new Constitution. Giving Al-Azhar some power here, then it shifts everything to a new battleground, which is who controls Al-Azhar. And Al-Azhar has been controlled up until now by under Taieb and his predecessors by a more moderate strain of thinking. But you do see Salafis talking quite openly about how they want to get rid of that moderate leadership and put in, you know, quote, a more true version of Islam, which is a much more conservative version. So bottom line is Al-Azhar will continue to be a battleground, an ideological battleground among all of these different constituencies.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Next question comes from Virginia Pierce with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
My question is related to the conversation that has just been going on, in the sense that I attended a session in Congress in which there was discussion about a constitution that was being developed around the time of the election. And at that point, there was an Al-Azhar representation which was more moderate, and the feeling was that if the U.S. had pressed more for inclusion of rights of religious minorities, then the constitution that was developed under Morsi would not have gone the way that it has. So, given all of this, what do you see are the forces that would encourage more protection of minorities in the development of a new constitution?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the notion that had the U.S. pressed harder for protection of minorities in the last constitution, that would have happened. U.S. pressure has a interesting way of backfiring on it, and I just wouldn't overstate the amount of influence that we have. The U.S. was pressuring, I think, maybe pressure is not the right word, cajoling, trying to influence various points of pressure that we have to say, look, you know, we support democracy. Democracy is not simply an election. It's the protection of rights, protection of minority rights, protection of freedom of speech, protection of gender equality. You can look across the board on the Constitution, and there were, areas where we were disappointed in many different respects. So I'm not sure. It's not that the U.S. was being silent. I think it just wasn't really being listened to. Going forward, now you have no pretense of a democratic process taking place. I suppose there is some pretense in that the new military-backed government wants, presumably at some point, to rejoin the democratic process, in quotes here. Meaning they feel the need to, call for elections in 6 months, and they talk about an inclusive process, but I'm not sure that they're actually going to follow one. So if, in fact, the military is calling all the shots and writing the Constitution, well, that's one place where we do have some influence, and you might see pressure to include minority rights get some reception with this process. But again, I come back to the possibility that, backlash against U.S. pressure is always real.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Your next question comes from Steve Spector with Stony Brook University.
Thank you, Isabel, for such an informed and lucid conversation. My question is, why didn't the protesters and the army wait for the problems that they saw to be resolved democratically? Did they feel that by the time that happened, it would be too late? Was there some sort of time pressure?
Well, I think, I've asked that question myself. And why did they really start out saying that if you look at the Tamarud movement, their call was for Morsi to step down. That was what their call was. It was not to hold a referendum. It was not to hold early elections. It was to use the power of the street to to topple the government. And that's what they did. And I don't like to subscribe to conspiracy theories. There are way too many in the Middle East. But I wonder if there was not some alignment of interest here with people saying, okay, let's use the crisis, this emerging crisis, the economic crisis. And, you know, look, again, I don't want to ascribe to conspiracy theories, but I do give some credence to the Muslim Brotherhood claims that their economic woes were certainly exacerbated by the deep state left over that was constricting, you know, fuel supplies and encouraging or facilitating the brownouts that have been rolling across Egypt this summer. Because, look, you know, the government takes the new military government comes to power, and these brownouts immediately stop, and the petrol lines disappear. And I've been the last year that I've been in Egypt. It's astounding seeing people. I mean, it's waiting in line hours and hours to try to fill up their cars, and now overnight these disappear, which makes me think, well, they were artificially created, as the Muslim Brotherhood was complaining this spring. So, you know, why did they not revert to the democratic process? Well, I think because there was a fear on the part of the liberal secularists and the military that they couldn't win in a democratic process, that they did not win in a democratic process, that they had lost every election they participated in. And I think they felt that their window was closing on them, and that's why.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Simi Ahmed, Ahmed from Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you, Isabel, for a wonderful presentation. You know, you just pointed out something that makes a lot of sense regarding the, you know, the why they did not go via the democratic route, because they probably would not have won. My question is, we projected Turkey as the model for Arab masses to follow. So don't you think by not calling this coup a coup, we are undermining our credibility, and also we have left Turkey out on a limb by not supporting its demands that the elected president be reinstated?
Well, I two different things. I would say that, and I have said publicly, I've written this, I've said this numerous times on television, we should call a coup a coup. I think it was a coup. We should call it a coup. And as I said earlier, we don't have a lot of leverage with the Egyptian government. The little leverage we have is through our military aid. And I think by suspending that aid, it gives us the leverage to say, okay, we'd all like to reinstate it. Here are the things you need to do. Which you've stated that you want to do, which is to hold an election and get back on that democratic, you know, process, and that at that point we can reinstate the military aid. So I do think that's important. I think at this point trying to reinstate Morsi, it's not going to happen, and I don't think that the United States should be publicly calling for that. I think that water is under the bridge, that, you know, horse is out of the gate, and what we should be doing is trying to work in a constructive fashion to go back to a democratic process in Egypt, because I do firmly believe that it is only through a democratic process that these deep divisions in society can possibly be reconciled.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lawrence Edward Carter with Morehouse College. It was take our next question from Shad Qubaid with Muslim Peace Coalition. And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1.
And thank you, Isabel, for such an astute presentation. The Salafi role, why should it be surprising when they will blindly follow the Salafi sheikhs from Saudi Arabia? And right now, the Saudi and UAE Egyptian Palestinian Authority group is on the ascendancy compared to the Iran, Hezbollah, Syria on one hand, and Turkey and Qatar and Muslim Brotherhood. My second question is, why is not the U.S. worried that after what happened in Iran in 53 with Mossadegh and later in Egypt under Nasser with the Muslim Brotherhood and in Algeria, it gave rise to violent anti-American movement both in Iran as well as Al-Qaeda rose after the what happened in Egypt with Sayyid Qutb and also in Algeria. So if we don't take a firm stand, what is there to prevent an Al-Qaeda 2.0, which will be much more energized and will have broader support than the present Al-Qaeda?
On your first question of surprise about the Salafists, my surprise was not that the Salafists were against the Muslim Brotherhood, but simply that you had this seeming partnership between the secular liberals and the Salafists. I mean, they were on the same page, this, you know, marriage of convenience that clearly lasted a very short time because they are so diametrically opposed ideologically. With regard to the United States being concerned about radicalism benefiting from this, that's exactly my point. I think that's a very real concern, and the United States at this stage right now, we are damned if we do and damned if we don't. We have the Muslim Brotherhood convinced that we orchestrated the coup against them and that we have undermined them. We also have the secular liberals in society feeling as if we partnered with the Muslim Brotherhood and betrayed the principles of the revolution. So, you know, that we've got all sides angry with us right now. And I think the only thing we can do is stick to a line that we support democracy. We're not picking sides here, but we come down on the side of a democratic process, which means that the Islamists who represent a very large portion of society, how big today, we don't know, but we know it's big. They won every election that has been held post-Mubarak. And yes, people's anger and bitterness to the incompetence of the government escalated, but it doesn't mean that they've lost all support in the country. They cannot be ignored. If they are ignored and they are repressed, it will only lead to more extremism and more violence. I feel that very strongly.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Why are the liberals not learning from the U.S. The way the United States of America was formed and even Indian Constitution? It takes a long time for democracy to take roots, and also once you allow the military to come in, that will negate the democracy. So why are the liberals so, you know, I'm not talking about those who are corrupt elite, but, you know, the real liberal intellectuals, why are they not seeing the danger of aligning themselves with the military and trying to overthrow a government within just 1 year of its election?
It's an excellent question. I don't have a good answer for you because I asked the same question myself, but all I can say is that for whatever reason, they made a decision in the last year that the Muslim Brotherhood at this point was the military, I should say, was the lesser of two evils in their mind, that the Muslim Brotherhood had seized the reins of power and had driven through a constitution that was not inclusive, a constitutional process that was not inclusive. And let's be fair, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood made some very egregious mistakes. I mean, I think the nail in the coffin was appointing a representative of Gama Islamiyah to be the governor of Luxor. And, you know, you see and that type of extremist move, Ghana Islamiyah, just to remind you, is the group that, yes, it has renounced violence today, but back in 1998, it was responsible for the terrible attack on the Taurus in Luxor that resulted in scores of people being killed. And, you know, here's a community, Luxor, that it depends 100% on tourism, and to have an extremist put into the governor's office was just too much for people there and people in Cairo to bear. And, you know, I think that there was a feeling that grew over time that the Muslim Brotherhood was more dangerous than the military. I think they're both dangerous. It takes an enormous amount of effort to get the military out of politics. Clearly, the military was never really out of politics in Egypt, but they are so back in the driver's seat in such a big way now. I think this is a bargain that the liberal secularists will come to rue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Leonard Rogers with Global Initiative Incorporated.
Thank you, Isabella, for your study and comments. How do you read the fact that the military backed the democratic election in Egypt when Morsi was installed, knowing his background in the Brotherhood? Does that not give us some substance that the military and al-Sisi, head of the military, are interested in democracy and are not altogether political, and that they're protecting the nation until they have a second chance at the democratic process?
I just want to make sure I understand your question. That when they backed Morsi, it was that they were taking sort of a high road, that they would back a democratic process and then hope that someday they would have a second chance?
Yes.
I don't think the military has ever really been particularly interested in democracy. I think the military is pretty much solely interested in protecting their privileges. And I think what happened after the election, after the parliamentary election, which of course delivered a majority to the Islamists, and then the presidential election, which brought... Now, you have to remember that Ahmed Shafiq, who was the military's candidate, did surprisingly well. And in the runoff, he got 48% to Morsi's 51%. So I think the military went through the democratic process thinking that, in fact, their guy might even win, which he had a very good showing. I mean, it is not inconceivable that he would have won. Had the liberals not divided the vote so much, it's possible that they would have done even better. But regardless, when Morsi was elected, the military, I think, moved quite quickly and had moved even prior to that to cut deals with the Muslim Brotherhood, saying, look, you guys, we know you're going to have political power, but we hold the real reins behind the scenes. Don't cross us. Make sure that we're protected. And if you look at the constitution that the Morsi government created, it preserved the privilege of the military government in Egypt. I mean, of the military institutions in Egypt. It had a budget that was opaque, and it had no review. So the military was able to basically create its own budget and not have any scrutiny over that budget from any quarter. So, you know, you saw the military still have enormous financial privilege, and ultimately have a lot of power in this new system. I mean, so much power, of course, that they were able to orchestrate this coup. So, you know, I think that the military was willing to go along with the process as long as their interests were protected. And for whatever reason, that calculus changed over the course of this spring, where for maybe they viewed Morsi as being too incompetent, too divisive, whatever it may be, that... You know, people were clamoring, you know, for a change, and that they could, at relatively low cost, step in and make that change happen.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rabbi Rosenthal with the National Council of Synagogues.
Yes, thank you for the wonderful presentation, Dr. Coleman. Given the chaos in Egypt currently, how do you view the future of the critical treaty of peace between Israel and Egypt?
I don't see anything undermining that peace agreement from the Egyptian side other than chaos. And, you know, the Egyptians, they don't want war with Israel. I mean, they you know, this conversation I've had over the last several years with many, many different people across the spectrum, from your taxi driver to your Muslim Brotherhood leader to your liberal secularists all across the board, they recognize that war with Egypt or a dissolution of the peace treaty at a minimum would be a bad thing for Egypt. And I've never heard anybody articulate a desire for that. And I think that's probably as true as ever, because the chaos is so chaotic in Egypt right now. The last thing they want is to have something else on their hands. But there is a lot of instability in Sinai, and you know, you could imagine a situation where there is, you know, there are attacks on Israel from the Sinai that Israel retaliates, and it could escalate from there. I mean, you could imagine that type of scenario, which I think would be bad, of course, for both sides. But, you know, I was just in Israel. I got back yesterday, and there's tremendous concern about what's going on in Egypt, what it means for Sinai, and, you know, in the context of what's going on in Lebanon and what's going on in Syria. You know, it's this border, which has been quiet basically for years and years, is now looking much less quiet and more volatile, and the Israelis are watching it very closely. But I really don't think that there's any Egyptian momentum for undoing the peace treaty.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Azim Farouki with Islamic Center of Rockland, New York.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Coleman. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I had the honor of speaking to you last time when you had your book, Paradise Under Her Feet. So it's wonderful to hear from you. I haven't, but the question that's bothering me is, first of all, my Egyptian friends here in Rockland County at our mosque, they are actually delighted that Mr. Morsi is now deposed. And my question that comes to me, and they cannot answer it really, is that why do you think the Muslim Brotherhood enjoys popular support, even though they seemingly do not protect the minority groups, which is obviously an essential element of any Islamic government?
You know, I think that the Morsi, the let's separate Morsi for a moment from the Muslim Brotherhood, because I don't know how popular Morsi ever was himself. And remember, he was a third choice for the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate for president. You had a couple of others who were disqualified for a variety of reasons. I mean, Harit al-Shatter, of course, is one of the big powers behind the Muslim Brotherhood. But Morsi was the stand-in candidate. And he's not a politician. He's personally quite drab and not got a lot of zip and zizz as a politician. But let's talk about the Brotherhood as an organization. I mean, I think it still has, it's got deep roots across the country. And it has been very effective as an opposition movement. Now, the last year, it has not been an opposition movement. It's been the government, and it has not risen to the challenge. I think it's displayed its incompetence in some respects. It's displayed its authoritarian tendencies. It's displayed its desire to amass power. It's displayed its tone deafness when it comes to politics. This appointing, as I said, of the Gama Islamiyah person in Luxor is a very divisive move. So, you know, it did not handle things well. That, I think, could certainly account for a decline in popularity, but it does not mean that the organization goes away by any means in the country. It's still a very big social movement, not only a political movement, but a social factor and a deliverer of services. I mean, people depend on the Brotherhood for a whole variety of health care and education and all sorts of things. So, you know, to think that for your liberal friends in Rockland County who cheer that the Brotherhood, that Morsi's been thrown out of office, I think is quite short-sighted, because this organization's not going away.
Mm. Well, then that's the main reason, as you pointed out, that they perform so many good things in the country, you are saying.
Well, they are deeply embedded in the fabric of the country, and in terms of social service delivery, yes, they are an important player. I think that people have become more sophisticated politically in Egypt. Remember, this is a country that knew nothing. The majority of people not only knew nothing of democracy, they knew nothing of any leader other than Hosni Mubarak. You know, 70% of the population is under the age of 30. The only thing in their lifetime that they've looked to is Hosni Mubarak. So remove Hosni Mubarak, and the country's a little bit adrift. And you had an explosion of media, an explosion of political thought, of thinking of all these different things. And the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood, Islam is the solution, it resonated with a lot of people. But over the course of the Muslim Brotherhood being in power, I think a lot of people said, maybe Islam is not the solution to our rising food prices and our fuel shortages and all of the different things that are going on. And I think it undermined their support. We know it undermined their support, but we don't know by how much. And the more that the Muslim Brotherhood is repressed and plays the role of victim, which they can do very well, I am concerned that it will only re-energize the movement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question, and I apologize to those of you who we can't get to all of your questions, but we'll take one last one.
Thank you. Our final question will come from Azza Karim with UNFPA.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. Very, very quickly, I just wondered what you saw in terms of one of the things that you discussed at the very beginning, which I think is of remarkable importance for all of us, is the issue of minorities again. And I just wanted to say that I think there's been a huge amount of antipathy and very nasty and violent antipathy towards Shia minority in Egypt. And I would hope that that doesn't go under the radar screen when we consider the tremendous sense of anxiety about minorities as a whole, so that we consider that it's not only the Christian minorities which are in bad shape, but also the Shia ones. And I just want to commend the speaker once again on a very interesting discussion. I would also want to underline, if at all possible, that there's a huge split within the Egyptian community in Egypt and abroad, and this is bound to have repercussions on whatever call for democratic processes are being made, as important as they are. I think it's the first time, at least in my recollection, that I see a nation so split very, very deeply from the family onwards. And I just wanted to highlight that. Thank you.
Azza, thank you for those words. And it's nice to hear you on the call. I think that the point that you underscore about the violence directed towards Shia is also very important. As you well know, and maybe others on the call are not so familiar with, there was a horrific incident just a few weeks ago directed towards Shia in Cairo that resulted in the hanging of a number of Shia victims. And it was very disturbing sectarian violence that some, again, would say that the Morsi government, if it not necessarily encouraged this, but by not taking a firm line against the, you know, very sectarian line that's coming out of some of the more extremist groups in Egypt is allowing this to flourish. And my concern is you're exactly right that it is an incredibly divided country, a very divisive politics, divisive atmosphere right now. And that's the type of environment in which minorities come under attack. You've seen the attacks against Christians. We've seen attacks against Shia and of course, Baha'i also in Egypt. And these things, I fear we're going to see more of it, not less of it, given the very deep divisions in society and the tendency of people to want to blame the other and to scapegoat somebody. And, you know, minorities end up being those scapegoats. So my radar is very attuned to what I think is going to be increasing incidents of this type of sectarian and religious violence.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. Thank you for your valuable insights and analysis today. We appreciate it. And to everyone on the call for your questions and comments, I think we all agree it was a very rich discussion. As a reminder, you can read more on this issue and others by going to Isabel Coleman's blog, Democracy and Development, at CFR.org. And we're also following this crisis in Egypt and around the world, other hotspots. As you know, this conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, seeking to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars from across the country in conversations on a broad range of pressing international issues. As always, we appreciate your feedback. Please email us at outreach@cfr.org with any suggestions on topics you'd like to see covered in the series. We hope that your summer is going well and look forward to your participation in future discussions.
Thank you, Arena, and thank you for everyone who participated on the call today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.